Friends, as the first speaker pointed out, the subject of our lecture today is truth and our civilization. And as was pointed out, as we say, truth is multifaceted. And there are many meanings and connotations of this word. First of all, sometimes we say truth as opposed to falsehood. Truth as opposed to deception, deceit, cheating. Truth as equal to righteousness and therefore opposed to unrighteousness. Truth also as moral verities or eternal verities, sometimes we call it as Sanatan Satya, as opposed to the fleeting ideas. But ultimately, there is the highest sense in which the word truth is used, that is why we call it Samvritti Satya or relative truth, which is nothing but relative knowledge, and Paramartha Satya, absolute truth or absolute knowledge, which is synonymous with wisdom. Now, the very first thing, truth as opposed to falsehood and deceit, something at the lowest level from which we have to really begin the subject, and then one by one we shall see all the other aspects of truth as well. Before we can comment, there is this first quotation from HPB, who has a lot to say about deceit and falsehood of our civilization. She says, "Who loves truth in this age for its own sake? How many of us are prepared to search for, accept and carry it out in the midst of a society in which anything that would achieve success has to be built on appearances, not on reality, on self-assertion, not on intrinsic value? We are fully aware of the difficulties in the way of receiving truth." And a little later down, she says, "In our century, man allows himself usually to be drifted down from cradle to grave, nailed to the procrustean bed of custom and conventionality. Now, conventionality, pure and simple, is a congenital lie, as it is, in every case, a simulation of feelings according to a received standard. And where there is any simulation, there cannot be any truth." This is something where she contrasts truth as against dissembling appearances. And we have mastered the art of dissembling in our civilization. The story which we have often repeated, but bears repetition, is the story called Chameleon by Anton Chekhov. You know, there is this little puppy who enters the timber yard and bites little finger of a worker there. So the worker picks up the puppy, goes to the police station and makes a complaint. Now the inspector there gets very furious and he says that, "Yes, I will teach a lesson to the owner of this little dog." While he is in the process of doing something, constable enters the police station and he looks at the puppy and says, "Well, do you know, this is our general's dog." So immediately he gets up from the place as if the general himself has come and picks up the dog in his hand, begins to caress and says, "Oh, what a cute little dog," and he starts shouting at the worker, "This little puppy, look how cute it is, how small it is, it cannot even reach up to your finger, leave alone biting your finger. But therefore, let me restore it back to the general." So off they go. On the way, they are hardly out of the police station and someone sees and says, "Arey, this puppy, where did you find it? It belongs to that poor farmer who lives, you know, down the corner of the street," something like that. So again he puts down the puppy and starts cursing and saying, "I'll teach that farmer a lesson. How dare he let loose a dog like that?" And we are told, it's a hilariously written. And of course at the end it turns out to be some street dog finally. But by turns, depending upon whether the dog belonged to the rich man or the dog belonged to the poor, he keeps changing his attitude, like a chameleon changes the color. So this is the thing, and very rightly therefore HPP says that simulation of feelings according to the received standard, and we are all guilty of it at some time or the other. We dare not express what we feel, and Dr. Eric Fromm in The Fear of Freedom, in his book, he says at one place that, look, when you are shown a simple thing, like a painting, you hear a piece of music, you read a book, and how many of us are able to be honest about it, truthful about it? You go to an art gallery with a friend and you see a picture and you may not have liked so much. But the moment you see there the name is Vincent van Gogh or Picasso, you will say, oh, what a beautiful, gorgeous painting. And you are given a book to read, well, you might find it completely boring, especially the classic. It is said about classics that it is something which all people want to have read, but very few have actually read it. So, when you are given this classic, maybe Charles Dickens, maybe Shakespeare, it goes over your head, but you say, hey, it was a fantastic piece of writing. Why? Because he says, from the childhood you are brought up to understand that this and this, they are great authors, great artists, and it's a mark of good taste to admire and understand the art of these people. Similarly, there is dissembling, we can say, when we meet people. When they see us, they are so good on our face. When we see them, we are so good on their face. And then as soon as their back is turned, we are just waiting for that and we will say something nasty. We want to gossip. And H.P.B. beautifully brings this aspect out in an article, The Is Denunciation of a Duty. She points out that in the early civilization, the Roman civilization, people died a relatively quick death when they were thrown into the arena against those ferocious beasts. The beast would tear them apart and in no time he would be dead. But our civilization, with all these so-called enlightened, civilized, educated people, you find that in the society cats, the ferocious and graceful cats with their polished nails, which are all the time being sharpened, behind closed doors, they are tearing apart the character of their own good friends. For some supposed vice or some supposed crime, maybe they have committed that crime or whether they have that vice or not, they are continually doing, as they say, the dissection of the character of the person. Now, this is something which she is looking down upon. But on the other hand, she says that denunciation is duty to truth. It is duty to truth with the condition that you don't denounce a person, but you denounce the cause of evil. Because more often than not, she says, take even our terrorists for that matter. Take criminals. Take any person who is committing a crime or has a vice. After all, she says, it's like blaming a leper who catches leprosy because he lives in a leper colony. The whole atmosphere of the society is what we have made it to be what it is. How can you condemn a person because he's part of it? So, you are not to condemn. If you at all want to denounce and condemn, condemn the very cause. Attack the cause and not really the person. But on the other hand, she also says that if you happen to be a public officer, if you happen to be a magistrate or a judge, it becomes your duty to denounce even a person. Because in the larger interest of the society, in the larger interest of community, in the larger interest sometimes of the nation, that you will denounce that person. But otherwise, even theosophy for that matter, she says, has got this sublime and solemn duty of exposing evil and redressing wrong. So let us read first that second quotation before we go on to say something more. Theosophy has to fight intolerance, prejudice, ignorance and selfishness hidden under the mantle of hypocrisy. It has to throw all the light it can from the torch of truth with which its servants are entrusted. It must do this without fear or hesitation, dreading neither reproof nor condemnation. Theosophy, through its mouthpiece, the society, has to tell the truth to the very face of lie, to beard the tiger in its den, without thought or fear of evil consequences, and to set at defiance calumny and threats. As an association, it has not only the right, but the duty to uncloak vice and do its best to redress wrongs, whether through the voice of its chosen lecturers or the printed word of its journals and publications, making its accusations, however, as impersonal as possible. But its fellows or members have individually no such right. Now, this is the mighty task for which the movement was launched. As you know, where the white dove of truth had no place whereon to rest her weary unwelcome feet. That is the time, we are told, Theosophy entered the arena and actually was there to expose the evils. Time-honored humbugs, social evils, evils which were there and wrongs which were there in the whole practice of spiritualism. The wrong ideas of society, religion, materialism of the science and what have you. So her journal was called Lucifer, the Light Bringer. And in that journal we are told, such great was love for truth, which was there even in HPB, that she used to give place to any article which had even a semblance of truth in it, because she said that it is worth going through the ton of rubbish if you can get from it and even an ounce of gold from that particular article. Now, but individually, we have no right to denounce. Also, individually, we are told, and you have no right to believe in the wrong of any person. You see, we all get a subtle satisfaction when you come to know about ill of another person. There is a subtle delight. A person who goes in the society in the name of being very upright, honest, someone comes and says that, you know, after all, just day before yesterday I heard that he also is taking bribe, or he also has this gossipy nature, and you are inwardly a little delighted that after all he is not as good as he is made out to be. But HPB says you have no right to believe in the wrong or evil of another man unless, of course, you have a first hand experience or unless you have undeniable proof for that evil which is said about him. How many times we really take care to find out whether what statement, bad statement which comes to us about another is 100% correct. And even if that be so, something only spoken from the platform but very difficult to do is, you should have charity for that person. Forgiveness, because keeping in mind the weakness of human nature, you must exercise charity even when you find that that person is in the wrong. But you are also, as a teacher, as a parent, as a superior, sometimes you have to speak the truth and tell your inferior, your child, your subordinate, that where do they go wrong? Unless you point out that error which they are committing or the drawback that there is in the character, they will not be able to improve. But then how do you do it? Yes, speak the truth at that time. Another thing she also points out there is that if by keeping quiet you find that the guilty person will go unpunished and an innocent is going to be punished, or a larger part of the society is going to be inconvenienced, then speak the truth at all costs. So, simple example, if there is a servant working in your house and if you catch him, maybe once, twice, stealing something, then well, it becomes your duty to warn your neighbor in whose house also maybe he works. Then you speak the truth. But she says, after much mature deliberation and also after consulting your conscience. So you've got to be very, very careful before you, as it were, go out and speak the truth regarding evil of another person. But as we said, it becomes our duty when we are in a certain position to really improve another's character, you have to point something out. Then how do you do it? You have to do it gently and on his face. This is actually from one of the Buddhist precepts which HPB has quoted in one of her writings. Condemn no man in his absence, and when forced to reprove, do so to his face, but gently, and in words full of charity and compassion. For the human heart is like the kusuni plant. It opens its cup to the sweet morning dew and closes it before a heavy shower of rain. If you harshly tell something, the child will not even want to listen to you, leave alone a grown-up. Even a child will turn a deaf ear to what you are saying. But if you gently tell, and to be able to convey truth, first of all, you should have cultivated that relationship with that person. You see, sometimes you tell something to a person, he will not listen. But another person who has a very good relation with that man, and if he points out the same error, this person wants to listen and also act on it. And this is really what Buddhists call as upai kaushalya. There is skill which we need to develop in even telling the truth We always say truth is bitter, but that bitter pill he will gulp very readily and laughingly if you have put it across in a right manner. And that is why not for nothing Buddha says about a wise man: he detects fault and blames what is blameworthy. Follow him as a revealer of hidden pleasure, because he admonishes and he instructs. He is not having any malice when he points out the fault. He doesn't have any feeling of superiority when he points out the fault. He has that love and compassion when he points out the fault of another man. And it is said about Mr. Judge, about from students who used to work with him, that they would be rather be reprimanded by Mr. Judge than be praised by him. Such must be his method of reprimanding and finding fault, that people love to be reprimanded rather than being praised by him. It was so very good he was at conveying that inconvenient, that fault in the person, that he didn't mind being reproved by him. Now, some of us, of course, don't have this way. We say, well, I call spade a spade. I don't mince words. I told him point blank. And that only means that you didn't take care to find out what will be the effect of your speech on that man. You need to do that. And that is why we are told about the laws of Manu, which says that let him say what is true, let him say what is pleasing, let him utter no disagreeable truth, let him utter no agreeable falsehood. This we have seen: let him utter no disagreeable truth, but also let him utter no agreeable falsehood. You see, sometimes in order to keep a good relation, or sometimes if something is at stake, we want to speak agreeable falsehood. There is that story, I think, which very much fits over here, about the emperor's new clothes. There was this emperor who used to be mad about having new clothes. Every day he would wear new clothes. And knowing his weakness, there are two impostors who run. They enter the city and tell the emperor that they are the best weavers and they are going to make the fantastic, fabulous costume for him. But it will cost money. So he says, all right. And they also point out that, look, this is the costume which will not be seen by any man who is stupid, any man who is not worthy of holding the office in your kingdom. These are the people who they won't be able to see what you are wearing. You see, it will be invisible to them. So fine, they begin the work, and we are told every day they ask for a lot of gold, lot of silk, and they are not really doing anything. And they are at the loom. The minister is sent to see what is the progress, and when he sees it, of course, he finds that nothing is happening, but lest he should be called a fool and a stupid man, he goes and tells the king, oh, it's a lovely thing which is being woven. Another very wise person in the kingdom goes and sees, and again he sees nothing, but he goes and tells the king, it's the best thing, really, I have never seen such a fabulous dress. And finally, the king himself sees and he finds nothing, but well, not wanting to be called stupid, even he feels that it's a lovely dress. And finally the day arrives and they do all the gestures of making the king wear the dress, removing of course all his clothes that he was wearing originally, and the procession is taken out. Everybody knows what is the condition. So the entire kingdom praises and praises it to the skies. What a gorgeous dress our king is wearing. But a little innocent child in the crowd says, the king is naked, he has nothing on. Now, he had the guts. You see, he didn't want to speak this agreeable falsehood. Nothing was at stake in being called foolish, if at all. Taking up the courage from the child, then the entire crowd says, yes, the king is naked and there is really no new apparel that he is wearing. So, no agreeable falsehood. It may seem like little thing, but it matters a lot when you come to philosophical truths. After all, again and again, if you read Crosby's writings, he is at pains to tell us, beware of pseudo-tolerance. He points this out, that in the early part of the theosophical movement, there were students who were very eager to please outsiders. You see? So, when they meet Christians, they would say, theosophy? Yes. More or less it's same as Christianity. A doctrine here and a doctrine there is different, but it is synonymous with Christianity. They would meet a Brahmin and say, theosophy and Brahminism is same. And Mr. Crosby points out, this is pseudo-tolerance. It is an agreeable falsehood because you don't want to displease that man. But in the process, you are compromising truth. What he is given in Christianity is in no way synonymous with theosophy. So, it does matter. Not even putting agreeable falsehood. Actually, the first sentence is the most difficult. Let him say what is true. That is what is our title. Truth and our civilization. Speaking the truth. Simple matters. If you have ever been and worked in an office, you will find that people will tell you it never works really to tell the truth. Array, and this is the example we have heard often say, array, if you want to get your leave sanctioned, you dare not write that you want to go shopping. You dare not write that you want to take your family on a vacation, so you want 10 days leave. You have to say, I've got a very bad stomachache. Or you have to say, your mother is ill or your father is ill, then the boss will sanction. This is the question which they put. What great thing you are talking about, truth and being truthful. We can't even get our leave sanctioned if we don't tell the lie. So, from there it all begins. If you say, try to be truthful and say, I will not claim my leave travel allowance or I will not claim my medical fund and medical allowance because I have not fallen ill. I have not gone anywhere. They say, don't try and be Satyavadi Harishchandra. Satyavadi Harishchandra. And they are right. After all, to be Satyavadi, to be truthful all the time, really entails in our civilization, which is so full of falsehoods everywhere, that it will make you undergo the kind of trauma and the sufferings which Harishchandra had to go through. There is just this morning we had the occasion of reading this story about a man, and it could well have been a true story and be no incidences of such real life happenings. It's about a station master who comes across a Swami who is traveling by train. And we are told that he tells the Swami, give me some discipline which I can carry through at least for a little while. So the Swami looks at him and says, all right, I tell you, speak the truth at least for 3 months without relaxing. So he says, all right. And in 15 days, as it were to test him, there is an inspector coming to the office. And you know what corruption goes on in railway, especially amongst the station masters and things like that. So he had decided to tell the truth. So he rattles out all the corruption which was going on in that particular section amongst the subordinates. He also admits that now and then I take a share of the bribe and all that. Now, everyone was in trouble. So what they do is, they tell the inspector that this is the only man who is the culprit. He is trying to pass it on to us and therefore he is put into the jail for speaking the truth. Now, we are told that the trial is carried out. He refuses to engage a lawyer because he says, I want to speak the truth. I don't want any lawyer to take up my defense. I continue to speak the truth. And the court is adjourned and the judge, of course, speaks to him aside from the trial room. And there he comes to know that this is the vow he has taken. Such and such is a guru. And he says that, well, I also follow that same guru. Then he comes to know the background and the truth of the whole thing. And finally, he is released. But meanwhile, his job is gone. The family has already deserted him. 3 months pass. And at the end of these 3 months, we are told that suddenly out of nowhere, he finds that the ancestral property which was held by the government, he is now getting compensation of 10 lakhs for that. So all that was lost, as it were, is restored back to him. Now the family comes running back to him and says, let's live together. And he says, no. Now I had a taste of truth. In 3 months, I learned so much. I want to not just follow for 3 months, I want to follow this truth for my entire life. You take the money if you want, but I am going to be a follower of truth. Now this also shows another thing. As they say, satyameva jayate. We don't have enough patience to wait for the truth to triumph. And unfortunately, sometimes it may not happen at the end of 3 months. It may take 100 years, as it happened in case of HPB. Let us not forget, HPB was called an imposter of the age. And 100 years later, the same Psychical Research Society had to take back the words and print a report Yes, saying that she was not an impostor. That all those phenomena which she performed were true. But by then, alas, she was already there. It can happen that you get the triumph of truth you may not live to see, but ultimately truth will triumph. So, that is what something which we are not having enough patience to hold on to. Trying it is. And paradoxically, therefore, in our culture we find that whereas we are so scared to tell the truth in little matters, you go to a television show like Sach Ka Samna and you dare to tell the truth which has no meaning at all just because you are going to be paid money for it. What's the use of going and telling after you have become a very successful TV actress that I, as a teenager, I was pregnant and I had an abortion. For speaking that, you will get some 5 lakhs, 10 lakhs. What is the use of telling everybody, washing the dirty linen in the public and telling that you had extramarital affair because you will have 10 lakhs? This is truth. It's mockery of truth in our civilization. Where it matters, you will not speak the truth. But because you get money, you are willing to speak the truth. So, quite another is the example of Gandhiji. You cannot have a lecture on truth and not speak about Gandhiji, whose whole life, like that man, in 3 months he found what it is to speak the truth. His whole life is called the story of my experiments with truth. Just two weapons, ahimsa and non-violence and satyagraha. Truth and non-violence, these were the two weapons with which he fought the British Empire. And this truth, satyagraha, it is relentless search of truth, not just in the political realm, in individual life, in social life, in religious life. Anything that he picked up, any field that he was going through, he was satyagraha, insisting upon truth. And that's like insisting upon good, insisting upon righteousness, insisting upon walking the path of truth. And he told his followers that path of truth, satyagraha, becoming a satyagrahi, it is not a weapon of a timid person. It is a weapon of a strong person. We are not here to do satyagraha and then in the process make enemies out of our opponent. Insist upon truth, but in such a way that your enemy should get transformed. He should get converted and he should swing on to your side and see the validity of what you are asking. If not that, at least he should stop obstructing your walking on the right path. At least that should happen. So this was satyagraha, and he said it is something which requires strength. And where will you get that strength from? So he told his satyagrahis, simple and pure life. You can understand that better. Just as it happens, yesterday we were studying The Friendly Philosopher and the word came up, tarba. Tarba, Jacob Boehme speaks about it, which is the great pressure, the great pull which is exercised by our material civilization. It is the great pull of the material nature of man himself, so that the moment he tries to rise above the dead level of humanity, the moment he tries to rise above all the evils in the world, badness in the world, he finds that as if like 50 people are pulling him down. Against that, what do you do? And Mr. Judge says that you need to first cultivate at your lower brains enough power, enough strength, so that you are not pulled down. And how do you cultivate that power? Very simple. By entertaining in your mind kind thoughts, by all the time being engaged in unselfish works and detaching yourself from worldly allurements. Simple and pure life. That's exactly what is summed up by whatever Mr. Judge also is putting over there. The karmic stamina, the inner strength, it can only come from doing altruistic works, from having higher, nobler feelings, and of course, step by step, detaching yourself from the worldly allurements. With that strength, yes, you can fight to the end the battle of truth. And that is why I think it's a glowing tribute given and Vadiaji in Das have I heard has made a mention of this particular writer, because it's a very different perspective. Sometimes you feel, oh, Mahatma Gandhi. After all, our concept of Mahatma is someone who is a perfected being. Why call him a Mahatma, a great soul? In what sense is this being said? After all, you are able to identify with this man, someone who was ordinary like us, and that same man, every step of his life is a struggle and a movement towards going nearer to truth. And that is what is said in this. Into a world lighted by truth, fed by it, kept alive by it, but yet ignorant of it, there came a man who sought it, felt it, and declared it. This man, whom people call Mahatma, the great soul, lived so that men could know that there is a power more real than the power of money or weapons or prisons, and through it men could break the ancient chains of violence. In a world where men were in bondage, he found freedom in truth. The greatness of Mahatma Gandhi was not simply that he freed India, but that he himself grew toward truth. And therefore we can emulate such a person, that in whatever little measure, you don't have to compare him with the Mahatmas, in whatever little measure he tried to live the life of truth and righteousness, we can emulate him. So, in this society therefore, where we are actually finding it so difficult to tell even simple truths, here were these giants who tried to live the life of truth. Now, coming to the last aspect of truth, which is really on which HPB has written the article, What is Truth, pamphlet number 17, is regarding the Samriddhi Satya and Paramartha Satya, relative knowledge and absolute knowledge. We are told over there that what knowledge we have, the truth as it were of things that we are trying to find out, is only limited. You have your five senses and you see things with them. You have your mind, so you rationalize. And you understand of that thing as much as your senses and your mind can tell you. But there is something more to it than your mind and your senses can convey. A blind man, if you give him a rose, he will hold in his hand and tell you something about it from the smell, from the touch. We can say something more using all our five senses. And give it to a chemist, and he will even tell you the chemical composition of the rose. But Immanuel Kant said, there is something called thing in itself. And it is not for nothing that that great poet in his poetic intuition has written Tennyson, Flower in a Crannied Wall, where he says, Flower in a crannied wall, I pluck thee out and I hold thee in my hand. As I hold you, if I can only understand root and all in all, then I will understand what God and man is. You see, knowing the flower as it is plucked out, but knowing it root and all in all, then I will know what God and man is really trying to understand the essential nature of thing. That even in that flower, there is the essential nature, knowing which you will know God and man, because that essential thing is the same in all. Know it in one and you have known it in all. The hidden aspect, as we say, the root of everything, man and nature, is in eternity. And knowing that essential is really having the absolute truth. But is it so easy? It isn't. And we have to go step by step. We have our senses, we have our reasoning mind. We can even develop the astral perception and astral senses and know something more than the ordinary. We can become, as the voice of the silence says, tattva jnanis. You know, there are 24 tattvas which Sankhya philosophy speaks about. But beyond that, you become atma jnani, who is even higher than the tattva jnani, who knows the ultimate essence, the prime mover of everything which is in everything. So, to reach that state is very difficult. Meanwhile, we have only the glimpse of a few facets of truth. And that is why, as the first speaker pointed out, let us not be very sure in passing judgment and saying that this is the ultimate thing. As one of the masters says in one of his writings, that when you have learnt and understood something about, say, life or about certain doctrines, please don't make another man see things the way you do. Don't force it on him to see it the way you do, because who knows, tomorrow morning you may wake up and find that you have to change your entire understanding. A new meaning may dawn on you. Then now, where will you find that man and tell him that that was not the right understanding? Now this is the right understanding. So the quest of truth is something which is an ongoing quest, where you don't say that, is this the right answer? Yes, this is the right answer. I write it down. I remember it. What is truth? That should be my question. And it should be going on and on and on. It is not really something which you get at one stage or another stage. It's an ongoing quest. Now, that is why the Jainas have a very beautiful concept with which we are all familiar. They have something called the theory of judgment. It's called Nyayavada. That if you are pronouncing judgment on something to be true or false, or right or wrong, or what it is, then that judgment is not going to be final, because there is something called Anekantavada. That any object, any circumstances, any situation has got several aspects, several characteristics. So, for instance, there is a jug. It's a gold jug. And someone who looks at the jug from externally, he will say, it's a concrete thing, it's a substance. Yes, he is right. It's a collection of gold atoms. Someone who looks within says, it is non-substantial. Because he looks at the air within the jug, even he is right. Someone says, it's a jug which is made by Mr. So-and-so, he is right. Someone else says, it's an elongated jug, not a square, not a circle, not a sphere, even he is right. So, they say that from a particular point of view, you are right. When you make a judgment of something in the world, then you are right, but your judgment is conditioned. Conditioned by your perception, conditioned by your preconceptions, your conceptions, but you therefore, every naya must be qualified by the word syat. Syat meaning it may be so. In a way, it may be so. From one point of view, looked at from one angle, it is this. But looked at from another point of view, it may be something else. So, syad, actually, the whole concept of syadvad is used in and applied to our struggle towards truth, and also in cultivating the tolerance towards other religions. There is other story which brings up the same idea, where we say that there were six blind men, and they were trying to really tell what is this elephant like. And one of them touches the trunk of the elephant and says, it's like a horse pipe. Another touches the leg of the elephant and says, it's like a pillar. The third touches the tail and says, well, elephant is like a thick rope. All of them are right, and the six blind men are the six Indian schools of philosophy. But is any of them having a complete picture of the elephant? No. Each one is partially true, and so each philosophical system, each religious system is partially true. It is in possession of partial truth. But all the scriptures put together, all the philosophies put together, still does not equal to the ultimate absolute truth, because it belongs to a level and a perception which is altogether on a different plane. To really apprehend what we call as absolute truth, it is something where one has to exercise intuitive perception, direct perception, where there is a conjunction of buddhi and mind, at least for a little while. And in the very last quotation, on the second page, HPP in her own words says this: outside a certain highly spiritual and elevated state of mind, during which man is at one with the universal mind, he can get not on earth but relative truth or truths from whatsoever philosophy or religion. So, this also brings out another question which the preliminary remarks had brought out. What is going to be our yardstick for measuring whether a particular system is giving truth or falsehood? That is a great question. And here we are given certain criteria for judging it. Simple criteria. Like truth is something which is universal. It is akalika, timeless. If it is true in India, it has to be true in America, in Paris, in London, anywhere in the world. If it is true today, it must have been true yesterday, it must be true tomorrow. And therefore, we need to distinguish between conventionality and customs on one hand, which keep changing from person to person, maybe society to society, nation to nation. But truth is universal. And also, the one who expounds the truth will never say, "Behold, I know." He will also have the humility to say, "Thus have I heard." When HPP, though she gives the kind of knowledge which she has given out, she could have easily said, "I say so and follow it. And it's a revelation which I am giving, and I'm sure half the humanity would be ready to believe the kind of tremendous knowledge and wisdom which she has passed on." But even she has such great humility in the initial pages of The Secret Doctrine, where she says, "What I'm about to give in this volume is not something which I am giving out." In Isis Unveiled, she says, "I'm only bringing the string to really tie the bouquet of nice flowers, colorful and good smelling flowers. That is all that I am bringing. And what I am going to give is not a revelation. It is to be found scattered throughout the volumes of the scriptures, of Puranas, Vedas, Upanishads. You will find it all there. I only collected them together and I am giving it." This is the humility and that no claim for revelation of any kind. And also, the person who gives the truth, he also gives the method for verifying it. This is what also Mr. Crosby points out. That if you know that you have theosophy and that means you hold nuggets of gold, don't try to force it, not required. Hand it over to another person. If you are having gold, what will you tell another person? "Take it, test it and see." And you are 100% sure that it will stand the test of time. It will stand whatever test it is subjected to. So all you need to do is just give them the criteria for finding out whether what you are giving out is truth or not. And Buddha, we know, when Aunt Gautami asked Buddha that, "Prabhu, all your disciples, they are teaching your teachings and so many different things. I don't know what is the truth. What is really your true teachings in all this?" Now Buddha could have been very easily, he could have said, "What comes out of my mouth, take that to be the Dhamma. Take that to be Sanatan Satya." But he doesn't say that. He says, "Whatever you find helps you to get contentment as against discontentment. Whatever helps you to become more brotherly as against unbrotherly. Whatever helps you to become more detached as against being attached." And a whole list of virtues he runs through and says, "Then know this to be the norm, know this to be the Dhamma, know this to be the truth." So even he gives a criteria for judging what is truth or not. The problem is that we are not willing to apply our mind. So very simply put, Mr. Crosby says, truth is not a statement, truth is not a book, truth is not a man. Truth always explains. When you have found the explanation, you have found the truth. But are we willing to really verify it so that we ask questions and then find, yes, here is the answer? If you do that, you will know that it is true or not. And of course, there is another thing. Besides the rational way of finding out whether this is true or not, at times, as Mr. Judge says, there is a heart response. There is a heart response which says, this is true. In fact, he goes into a long explanation saying that each man is fitted in him the whole set of wires which are such that they vibrate only to truth. So when truth is spoken, sometimes some vibrations within you, as it were, is felt. This must be right. This sounds right. So that is that intuitive feeling which sometimes speaks up and says, this is the truth. So combining reason and trying at the same time to develop intuition, we may know what is truth. that is the process in which, as we said earlier, purity is something very important. It's not for nothing that Aldous Huxley also says, knowledge is a function of being. As there is an increase in the growing in the being of a person, there will be a proportionate increase or proportionate change in the quality and also the nature of knowledge that we have. It is all right to be selfish and whatever we are, and you can amass all the worldly knowledge, but not so about truth, not so about absolute truth or wisdom. You need to change from within. And of course, lastly, when you have that truth, you need nothing else. And that is why in the Gita we are told, for a truth realizing Brahmana, there are about as many benefits in the Vedas as in a tank which is stretching free on all sides and from which water has run out. So once you possess truth, you don't carry books. You don't carry boat on your head when you have crossed over to the other shore. We have still 5 minutes for any questions. Which is the ultimate knowledge. But it's an ongoing quest. So, in a way, it looks like you can never arrive at it. You can arrive at it. But for a given manvantara, for a given manifestation, it's an ongoing truth, because for a given manvantara, for a given manifestation, we talk about perfection. After all, that reaching absolute truth, reaching realization, it's all one and the same thing. So don't we say that it is ever-growing perfectibility? And why do we say that? It's because in these circumstances, in this kind of matter, material envelope and external circumstances, whether we are able to realize the spirit within with all these kind of impediments, then go to another kind of environment, a different matter, a different environment, and you are faced with a different kind of challenge then, and once again it is the same story of perfectibility repeated on a higher level. Otherwise why? On earth we say it's an inferior planet and there is only a certain knowledge, limited knowledge you will have. Once it goes into dissolution, our evolution will continue. And there are some in the seventh round and seventh race, we say it will be a race of Buddhas and Christ. And when you say Christ or Buddha, it's self-realization. And yet those beings also will once again continue their perfection. Not the way in which other inferior beings will continue, those who have not reached self-realization. But in some other way, again, they will try and have that struggle of self-realization in that environment. You know? So it is ever-growing perfectibility because the environment is different. The casing is different, the matter is different, the instruments are different. That's the whole leela, as it were, through which you have to go on. But we need not get disappointed. At least as far as the earth life is concerned, we know that there is an end. There is the highest thing, which is becoming like a Buddha or a Christ. So the highest, as much as can be achieved on this earth, at least we can strive for that. To that extent, there is ever growing perfectibility, never-ending quest for truth, not settling for in between. Why? Because some people feel, as Mr. Judge says, you have developed certain powers, and they feel that all right, they have already reached the end. That illusion can come about. Whereas it's only acquiring some psychic powers, which look so very similar to being like a very wise person, a very advanced person, that you can get into the illusion of thinking that you have reached the ultimate truth. That is why the caution that it is an ongoing process. The self-realization is the ultimate thing. It was not.
It was the experimentation was based on the development of ethical qualities.
It was Gandhiji's experiments with truth were not anything like, it was not a quest for knowledge in which we are asked to go. But yet, that is also required. Without the ethical qualities, as we said, you will not go very far. After all, in getting wisdom, it is breadth of mind, depth of mind, and poise to draw it towards the dinosaur. So without that selfless action, without the righteous life, you can't go very far by doing, cutting it off and only going in the quest of knowledge. You can go on reading volumes and volumes, study scriptures, and increase your breadth and depth of mind, and you can end up, in fact there is a far greater danger in that direction. Because as at one place she says, a great intellectual, he can make an entire humanity a footstool and he can really climb on that. So intellectuality, as Mr. Jack said, it will surely take us all to hell. Now why? So there is greater danger there of going in a wrong direction than in the direction of truth. Whereas here, sooner or later you will understand that mere righteous life, mere good and ethical life is not enough. I require knowledge. But you begin with devotion. This is what Mr. Jack says also in notes on the Bhagavad Gita. That there are several devoted men I know in Germany and in other places who, so to speak, from within they have certain wisdom, certain knowledge. But a wise man is someone who combines knowledge with wisdom till he comes to a point where he is a perfect master of both knowledge and devotion. So you begin with devotion, you begin with a righteous life, which is not at all to be compromised with at all. But sooner or later you add, and that's why we say, Gandhiji is not a Mahatma in the sense in which we understand the term. But even to live that life in the face of the kind of society in which we live, it is in itself a great thing. And that is why he is a struggling soul somewhere, at least higher than us, who has tried to apply whatever little knowledge he was having. People talk about a lot of ethics and morals without applying. He didn't just talk about ethics and morals, he tried to apply. So that truth is at one level. And this truth is at a completely different level. But we need to take everything into account, because what's the use of talking about the highest level of truth when people are not even able to speak the truth? You see, the very first step from which you climb, as she says, in this civilization people don't even appreciate truth for its own sake. They'll even lead you astray and say, don't have to speak the truth, be practical. So first inculcate in yourself the love of truth for itself, then you can go to that stage. That's why we had to bring this out, because it's a tremendous idea of Satya or Satyagraha. Our time has run out.